people might look at the age in the last couple of years and, you know, might be put off, but I don't think that's a reason to be put off. I feel like the last couple of years, obviously playing a little bit less, almost my body's kind of recovered from all the aches and pains that I've had before. So, and obviously my experience, obviously I feel like that counts for a fair bit. So, no, I've not really had too many offers. I'm quite open in terms of, you know, where I want to play. I feel like if it's here or abroad, I'd be quite open. So it's not like I'm being quite picky or anything like that.
Well, I was going to say, because you mentioned school run and stuff. So, you know, family location has to play a part, doesn't it, as well? I mean, by the time, you know, when you look at the bigger picture.
Yeah. You think that with mum, I've got a son who's not, you know, he's seven, he's quite young. I've got quite a young family, really. So we're kind of, I would be, you know, open to having a new experience a new culture. I wouldn't mind a bit of that if it came. And if not, then obviously, you know, everyone says this, you want to be local and near schools. But I don't think it's that. I feel like I'm quite, you know, adaptable, really. And especially kids as well, you know, they're adaptable too.
Rory?
Yeah, is it... I was going to say, is it difficult to kind of get your head around the idea that you might have to accept what comes along after the career you've had? Or are you kind of at the point now where you've seen the season start, so, you know, six, seven, eight games in, are you kind of just that you just want to play again?
Yeah, I think so. The hunger and the drive is still there. I don't want to sort of pack it in. Otherwise, I probably would have done as soon as, you know, I played my last second for Palace, probably the last game of the season. So it's not that I've really kind of really done a lot of fitness as well. So I feel, you know, in probably a better place than I might have been in previous years. So I feel like I'm ready just to go into a team. That's literally my next step. That's what I kind of want. And I don't want to, maybe it's, you know, that I've been a bit stubborn and I don't want to call it that.
Well, we wish you well, James. Hope you find somewhere soon. Thank you very much for coming on.
All the best, mate.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank
guys.
You.
Cheers.
Good to have you on. James Tompkins with us. He looks for a new club for this season. Connor, as ever, thank you. Where are Leicester this weekend?
We are Bournemouth at home, so I've been watching this game intently. James.
Right.
Thank you very
much. Have you been making notes?
I've been jotting for when I go into Malaya.
all right, good. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Voice of Sport, thank you.
Yeah,
maybe just work on the tact for next week's
game. I can't believe you blamed me for that interruption to James Tompkins. That's outrageous.
That's it for this week's MNC. Thanks for listening and for watching a shortened version. Probably without a lot of the stats, will be available as a Football Daily pod a little bit later on. Five Live Cricket up next after the news with Johnny Freeman.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks, Mark. Good evening. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has renewed calls for a ceasefire in the Middle East. He's spoken after holding a call with his counterpart in the US, Antony Blinken, this evening. There have been reports that Israel could begin a ground invasion of Lebanon as soon as tonight, following a series of airstrikes. Mr. Lammy says Britain and the US are concerned any further action could escalate tensions across the region.
We both agree the position that we had at the UN last week, that the best way forward is an immediate ceasefire and to get back to a political solution. And we both are urging de-escalation at this time.
An 8-year-old boy who died in a shooting at a farm in Cumbria at the weekend has been named by police. Jay Cartmell suffered serious head injuries in Walkop on Saturday. A man arrested on suspicion of gross negligence manslaughter has been released on bail. The BBC has partially upheld complaints made by the actor Amanda Abington against her dance partner on Strictly Come Dancing last year, Giovanni Panice. The corporation has apologised to her following a review and says it's tightened up protocols on the show. Liz Truss has accused the four Conservative leadership candidates of failing to acknowledge how bad things are for the party. Earlier, the former Prime Minister told the Tory party conference in Birmingham they need to think more radically.
I predict in the next 3 or 4 years we will have some kind of crisis. It could be an energy crisis, it could be a financial crisis, but things are heading in the wrong direction.
Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch addressed party members earlier. James Cleverly and Robert Jemrick will get their chance to do so tomorrow. And Australia's largest property website, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, has pulled out of attempts to buy its British rival Rightmove. The REA Group said it was disappointed its £6 billion offer had been rejected.
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous, though. Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Five Live Cricket.
Hey, evening, I'm Mark Chapman. Five Live Cricket on the way, but the second half is underway at Bournemouth, and Southampton have it all to do. Chris Wise.
They really do. They are 3-0 down, 2 minutes into the second half. Evan Nielsen, Ouattara, Semenyo with those first half goals for Bournemouth. And do you think Russell Martin isn't happy? He's made three changes at half time. Aribo, Ross Stewart, Ben Brereton Diaz, all off the bench, but as it stands, Southampton are going to remain very much in the Premier League relegation zone tonight. Bournemouth 3, Southampton 0.
Thank you very much. Nick Bright here at 10 o'clock. We're going to talk cricket over the next 55 minutes or so with Phil Tufnell, Sam Billings and Georgia Elwis. And just let me set the scene for you. So I'm in the studio. Georgia is in a beautifully set up room with a framed England shirt behind you there. Georgia, a couple of lovely photos. Is that a medal that's in there as well?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the World Cup winning shirt medal. Yeah.
Perfect.
My claim to fame.
Sam looks like he's in a stately
maybe
home.
I mean,
yeah, I know. He looks like he ought to have Henry VIII behind him chewing on a turkey leg. That's lovely wherever you are.
At the in-laws. So,
right. Wow. Yeah. Well, that looks great. And Phil is balancing his microphone on a can of baked beans.
Well, I've got the builders in at the moment, mate. So it's been chaos. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but at the moment, yeah, I'm in the sort of utility room with everything else surrounding me. I've got a bit of a cough and a cold. It's the end of the summer, isn't it? You know what I mean?
So that's how everybody is set up this evening. Real contrast between them all. Between now and 10, we'll hear from Heather Knight ahead of the start of the Women's T20 World Cup, which gets underway in the UAE on Thursday. We'll talk about the Delhi Capitals Group takeover of Hampshire and whether that is about to set a chain of events in process that we'll see an Indian takeover, to put it bluntly, of English cricket. 85058 if you want to get in touch, at 5LiveSport on social media. We are at the end of the summer now. We'll talk about England men's home summer first of all, which concluded yesterday with a 3-2 ODI series defeat to Australia. They won five of their six tests that were against the West Indies and Sri Lanka, and they drew the T20 series 1-1 with Australia. Overall, Phil, how do you paint this summer? And maybe the men's international summer might have the men's domestic summer playing into it? I don't know. But at the end of this summer, how do you feel?
Well, I mean, yeah, it was a bit of a low-key sort of summer, wasn't it? The likes of West Indies, and Sri Lanka. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, actually. You know, I liked seeing the West Indies and some of the new players coming over. I liked seeing Sri Lanka, who fought really hard and sort of gave England a bit of a run for their money. And I think England did have to fight hard. England are always going to be, you know, and so they should be very, very strong at home in their own conditions, you know, with the balls and what have you, and slightly seeming pitches. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I liked seeing some of the new guys coming in. Altogether, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think Australia being tagged on at the end of the summer with everyone with bobble-hats and duvets and puffers on, perhaps they might have got a little bit wrong, you know, as you say, the world champions come into town. You want to make a real big deal out of that. And I thought that was a little bit wrong. But all in all, I enjoyed the summer.
Bring Georgia and Sam in very shortly. Southampton's comeback has started, Chris Wise.
It's Bournemouth 3, Southampton 1. This is a glimmer of hope for Saints. Taylor, Harwood, Bellis stooping on the edge of the six-yard box to head in. Just moments before that, he'd had another header brilliantly saved by Kepa Arrizabalaga in the Bournemouth goal. It's only Southampton's third Premier League goal of the season, and it's Bournemouth 3, Southampton 1.
Georgia, low-key, would you go along with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've been completely spoiled, haven't we, really, this summer with the sport that we've had, and the cricket sort of gone under the radar. But again, as Phil said, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching England go about their business against West Indies, against Sri Lanka, and then a younger, new-look side up against the Aussies. I mean, I was still gripped. I'm a bit of a cricket badger, so I very much enjoyed there being so much of it. And I guess it was a shame that the Australia series was in September. The Aussies looked absolutely freezing cold yesterday down at Bristol, but they were sell-out crowds, so you know, they still got the appetite for it this deep into September.
Yes, although one of the reasons they have sell-out crowds is they sort of take some of them to places that don't get a load of international cricket, which some may argue is even more patronising in the end. I'm not saying who, but you know, you haven't had any international cricket, so I tell you what, we'll give you an ODI nearly in October.
Yeah, I know. I completely see that point, but you can't really win, can you? Because if you put it at the test playing grounds, then everybody will moan that they're only ever at the test playing ground. So I like seeing them at Bristol. I like seeing them at the smaller grounds. I think it poses a different challenge, and I actually really like seeing them up at Durham because that was a sellout, and for some of the you know, Bryden Carson and Matthew Potts as well to be playing on their home ground up at Durham, I thought it was quite a nice sentimental touch.
Do you think underwhelming is actually okay every now and then, Sam, in the sense that not if you have an underwhelming summer, it makes you appreciate the crash bang wallop summers even more?
Oh, maybe. I think you still want to have that product, especially from a cricketing perspective. We're competing with every sport now for people's attention, and it's never been more important to gain that attention and that interest around cricket. So, it was a little bit underwhelming. And I think, again, all the chat is around the schedule. I think the schedule really does have to change and has to be streamlined. I don't see the value in bilateral T20 series, if I'm honest. I think there's enough franchise cricket around that international T20s will be a thing of the past, probably down the line. So I think that then you can play more 50-over cricket and build up towards the Champions Trophy and make that a real showpiece in the centre of the summer. So I pick up on the guys' points around Sri Lanka and West Indies, having that exposure and for them having being the showpiece of the summer is fantastic. And world cricket needs a strong West Indies. It needs a strong Sri Lanka playing consistently, especially test match cricket, which is under fire from all angles at the moment. So underwhelming in some respects, but actually really important in others.
And that's the point, isn't it, Phil, really? We all want Sri Lanka, West Indies on tour here, but actually you want a competitive Sri Lanka and West Indies on tour here. And the world game, the superpowers, have a duty to make sure that there is depth within the world game.
Well, absolutely. And it all comes down to money, doesn't it? It's as simple as that. There's got to be that money spread around the global game. As you say, you know, the West Indies, fantastic side back in the day. Sri Lanka, a fantastic side. How are they going to get better unless you have these series and these test match series against England in England? You know what I mean? They would have taken so much from that series and sort of like put that into their test match playing and how that they're going to go about it. So, yeah, OK, you know, underwhelming. You can't have steak and chips every day, can you? Because then after a while, you get a bit bored with it.
Well, not if you've
you?
Got the builders in at the moment, no, Phil. You certainly can't.
I've just had a steak, to be honest.
That doesn't surprise me in that venue, Sam, to be honest.
In your medieval banqueting hall, I bet you had a lot. But, I mean, yeah, you have to have those kind of series all the time. You can't be playing Australia, India all these time. And you have to let these sides grow. I mean, obviously we talk about money, but it's also about experience as well. And they would have gained so much from that. And listen, I thought they fought hard. There were a couple of times when England blew them away, but you'd expect that, wouldn't you? But they would have gained so much experience from that, that then you think to yourself that when they go back, they're going to learn from that and come back stronger.
Sam's point is interesting, isn't it, Georgia, about, you know, with so much T20 franchise cricket in the world that dominates every season of a calendar year, very much, that actually men's international T20s are probably not needed from a cricketing point of view.
Yeah, to be honest, it's the first time I've heard anybody say that, but I completely understand where Sam's coming from. I think the men's calendar is so saturated, and there seems to be franchise tournaments popping up left, right and centre. We're seeing it, the cricket sort of crack America at the moment as well, and I think that will be the next big thing. So it really wouldn't surprise me. Something's got to give. You know, you just cannot expect these players to be producing quality cricket day in, day out, if they're on a conveyor belt of tournament to tournament, and the franchise ones are the ones that seem to be the most appealing.
Do you then keep you then keep like T20 World Cups, Sam, presumably?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a bit of time thinking about this in a hotel room various times, but I find it really interesting, actually, where I think you could just have it in terms of cycles. You can have a 12-month cycle leading up to a World Cup or a 50-over World Cup or the Champions Trophy, and specialise in that format. So all the white ball cricket that is played in the international game would be 50-over pre-World Cup next year. And T20, the internationals are only played sporadically or certainly towards a T20 World Cup, whenever that is. So I think that's a way that you could decongest the system and just create a bit of space. And the other thing, maybe in the future, I think one of the IPL CEOs said it a while back, in that Test cricket needs windows that has no competition around it. And the way you could potentially do that is Sri Lanka and West Indies could play Test match cricket in this country in that window. So you have three Test teams coming over for an English summer, for example, and we all play, all the different teams play three tests against each other in a kind of quad series or whatever. So just an idea and something that could potentially make it way more beneficial for those other maybe smaller nations as well, which struggle.
Chappers, I mean, we forever seem to be on here, don't we, talking about schedules and what should be done and congestion and how we can do this and what should get dropped and everything. But I don't really see anything ever being done. You know what I mean? Who are the people that are, you know, that are still sort of like, you know, have got this in their hands and got the power in their hands? Because it just seems to be getting more than more. Everyone who keeps talking about it keeps saying that this needs to be done, that needs to be done, but nothing ever seems to. If anything, it just seems to be getting more and more and more. I don't know really who sort of like.
No,
it's the short-term grab, isn't it? Each board is just worrying about surviving, I reckon, at the end of the day. And it seems to me that there's no long-term planning and long-term thinking around the global game, which is a shame. So I think the ICC have got their hands full at the moment.
I mean, they need to be very, very careful about it, though, I think. You know what I mean? Because otherwise, the next thing you know, we could be sort of overrun. And, you know, Test match cricket, as you say, we've been saying that it's low key and everything like that. Well, that just might go. Well, 5 years' time, that just might be gone.
Well, there's so much that could be affected by it, including the domestic cricket schedule, which we will come on to a little bit later. But Georgia, when you actually look at, say, the 50 over series tagged on to the end of the summer, bearing in mind the majority, if not all, of those England men probably haven't played any 50 over cricket since they last played it for England. They won't have played any domestic 50-over cricket. I'd be very surprised. I do wonder then how much you go into a 50-over international basically playing it like a T20 because that's all you have played when it comes to the white ball.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. I heard a stat on the radio that Harry Brook hadn't played a 50-over game since 2019, which is quite ridiculous, really. But, you know, that length of time, and he's then coming in as England captain and playing against a world champion. So, interesting, very interesting. And I guess you can see when they had the batting collapse, isn't you? And you see in the way that they're trying to play, it's very, very aggressive. And yeah, maybe they are thinking with the T20 hat on and still figuring out how to go about the tempo of that 50 over innings.
How hard is it then, Sam? Would it be, do you think, to switch from 20 over to 50 over? Mentality wise, building in, innings wise, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it is. It is tricky, of course, but it's way closer, obviously, compared to the Red Bull game and the Test match game. It's always a challenge flicking from format to format. But I think the point that George has made around young players, 30 now, the irony being, I personally think the 50 over game is the best format of the game for young players, whether it's club players, 15, 16, 17 year old. Girls and boys all up and down the country to learn their trade, learn their craft, because you have to have an element of batsmanship. Bowlers have to bowl 10 overs as opposed to obviously only four. So I think it fits both for Test match cricket in terms of development, but also T20 cricket as well. So it's a real shame that, I sound like an old player now, but
don't worry, mate.
But the generation. So my generation, when we came through with Owen Morgan's reset, we all grew up on 40 and 50 over cricket, and that's why you probably saw a huge improvement, but also how good that side was, the amount of players that grew up on that, less T20 than nowadays. So Jacob Bethell, for example, Harry Brook, as we mentioned, they're not growing up playing 50 over cricket. It's just T20 or T10 cricket. So, the skill level or the skills are very different. So it will take time to adapt. And that's why my point around actually having a substantial amount of 50 over cricket leading up to a World Cup is absolutely paramount for all these players and bowlers as well. Otherwise, you'd get the test bowling attack just playing the 50 over stuff.
And is it? I enjoyed the 50 overs. I mean, it's nice to see a little bit of sort of to and fro, isn't it? You know, it's nice to see ups and downs and people actually then having, as you say, batsmanship about having to dig themselves out a score and what have you. I think that that's what they've got to remember. I mean, there will be some guys, I think, coming back into that 50 over squad, won't they? I think the likes of Ben Stokes, perhaps Joe, I think Joe Root will be looking to come back into that. Obviously, Josh Butler as well.
Not bad. Not bad. Yeah,
absolutely.
Not bad trio to
absolutely.
Bring back.
Brendan McCullum as head coach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is going to be key, isn't it? I think I'm a huge fan of Brendan McCullum in everything he does, really. So people, I mean, we must remember that he didn't even want that job. That was the first job that he was offered, wasn't it? The white ball game. And he's now sort of being persuaded to take that on as a sort of like overall coach of it all, of English cricket, really. I mean, he's now running English cricket, so it's going to be interesting to see what he comes up with. I don't necessarily think he's going to be there for every game. I don't think you can be, really. And I think he's going to have his sort of seconds into command taking series as well. But it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what Brendan... Well, I know what Brendan's going to bring to that white ball game, and that is a sort of an re-energise and that spark... to get it going again. That's what that white ball English cricket setup has been lacking, I think.
But Georgia, when Rob Key was appointed director of cricket in 2022 and he split the roles, the red ball and the white ball roles, he said that's because he believed the requirements of the two teams were so different. Do you think McCullum himself has changed Rob Key's opinion?
Well, I think he's just so highly thought of and what he's done with the test team and the respect that he's got around the dressing room and through must be throughout the ECB as well, is speaking for itself. And I think the fact that Ben Stokes is willing to reverse his ODI retirement for McCullum speaks volumes of, you know, the coach that he is and what he can bring out of the players. Seems like a pretty laid back, relaxed guy who just allows them to take the shackles off and go out there and do their thing. And Will it work? I don't know. It's a lot of a lot for him to do if he's still living over in New Zealand. It's a 12-month of the year job. Like we're saying, the schedule is just absolutely crazy. So it remains to be seen how it will work, but I think it's a fantastic appointment.
I don't think he can be there for the whole lot. I just don't think it can be done. I think he's going to have to sort of like, you know, push it about a little bit and let other guys take over some of the other series.
Well, Rob Key said, Phil, the timing of the schedule will allow him to dedicate the necessary focus to both roles. We're confident the restructure will bring out the best in our players and coaching staff.
Well, there you go. So that's what he said. But I mean, whether he's going to be that hands-on, he's going to be hands-on for sure regarding everything, that's right. But whether he can be at every game putting the cones out, I'm not quite so sure. And I don't think you necessarily have to. It'd be interesting to see what Sam thinks about that. Do you need that coach there for every single series, so to speak?
I think what's been great around this series just now, actually seeing the elevation of someone like Marcus Trescothick to take the reins and the development around that. And that's one of Brendan's huge strengths is allowing other people to flourish. It's not about him. It is all that. I mean, that's the strength of the kind of leadership, and the definition of leadership is to uplift others. So, that's what he does. And I think that's the way he will do it, moving forward. And I think it's really good from Rob Key, actually realizing that a change needed to happen, and it probably hasn't worked out as he would have liked. I think what he said consistently has been, I'd rather get the right person or a top quality person for 8 or 9 months of the year as opposed to 12 months of the year. Or maybe someone average for 12 months of the year. So, like players, I think staff need that quality in Brendan, I think, is an absolute no-brainer. And you'll see the effect not only on the team, but someone like Josh Butler, as has been talked about a lot, you'll see him just, I think, a weight off his shoulders and really flourish.
What do you think the biggest challenges are for McCullum, Georgia, aside from time?
Balancing the squad with the players that he needs to fit in, if you're talking about having Butler, Root and Stokes come back in. And I think peaking at the right time. I think, as Sam said, there's not a huge amount of 50-over cricket being played before 50-over tournaments, and with a Champions Trophy on the horizon, he needs to work out, I guess, his best side very, very quickly.
Phil?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Trying to fit everyone in and get everyone going. I think Brendan, though, he kind of cuts all that away a little bit, the way he sort of works, I think. You know what I mean? He's a very sort of straightforward guy, very sort of motivational one, puts everyone, as Sam was saying, you know, just go out there and flourish. So it's not a huge amount of perhaps sort of necessarily tactics and all that kind of stuff. I think it's just about getting that culture right, and that's what he's so good at. So I think that that's what he's going to be concentrating on. Obviously, he's going to be concentrating on the Champions Trophy coming up, and they want to go there and perform really, really strongly. And then it's just about, as you say, squeezing everyone in, getting everyone fit, getting everyone roaring and ready to go, and managing schedules and everything like that. But I think he'll leave that to other people. I think what he'll be, he's just very hands-on about getting the guys ready to go out.
Does Ben Stokes need to come back into the 50-over side? And do England need Ben Stokes to come back? Bearing in mind a home test series against India and an Ashes tour. Sam?
No, to put it bluntly. Ben Stokes makes any team, when he's fully fit and firing, any team better. That is 100%. Just a fact. However, you know, his body, as always happens, I mean, he's had kind of struggles over the last kind of year or so. He wants to be that all-rounder in the Ashes down under. That is his focus. And I think to jeopardise that would be silly to try and spread himself too thin. But, I mean, we know that, you know, whatever Stokes he wants to do, that's what he's going to do. So, I don't see the 50-over team necessarily needing him as much as previously. But like I said, he makes any team better. But the Ashes should be the priority.
But also, George, if his fitness and his body will dramatically alter the balance of that team, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like Sam said, his priority has got to be him fit and firing in the Ashes, in the Test matches. And he's got Pakistan coming up from that point of view. Yeah. He's a doubt to be bowling in that series. But what we know with him is that, you know, he gives absolutely everything every time he steps out onto the pitch, whether he's fully fit or not. So it wouldn't surprise me if we did see him bowling, and that's just the kind of player that he is. But yes, balance aside, it would significantly be altered if he wasn't bowling.
I mean, Phil, I was just going to say to you, though, you know, we talked about the opponents for the Test series in the summer, but now, three Tests in Pakistan, three Tests in New Zealand, a five Test series at home against India, and then the Ashes. Now all of a sudden, that's gone up a level. At the same time, you're talking about bringing him back.
Well,
for the ODIs.
What do you do? What do you do? As you say, the schedule is absolutely crazy. If you're going to be playing everything, and that sometimes you're a victim of your own greatness as a cricketer, you know what I mean? It's going to be very, very difficult. If I was a coach and I wanted to sort of like, you know, he's going to have to prioritise a little bit about his main gun player, isn't he? I mean, I'd want him there. I'd want him there in the 50-over game coming up the Champions Trophy. I want him to be involved in that because he makes that side so much better. So that is going to be the decision that Brendan's going to have to make, isn't he? Do we keep Ben for Test match cricket, or do we sort of like just chop him in and out of 50 over cricket? You can't really do that. I'm a little bit with Sam. I don't necessarily think that Ben really, really would change massively that 50 over or that white ball side.
The one thing I would say as well, I'm always, I'm speaking from a squad playing point of view as well. I think it's very dangerous to just kind of put people in and out, regardless of who it is. I think, you know, from a team point of view, I think you've got to be committed consistently. And I think it can be detrimental maybe to the team if you're just kind of in and out and hand selecting when you want to play, really. Because if someone comes in and does well, you know, and then all of a sudden out to the side, it is Ben Stokes at the end of the day, so.
But you see my point. Yeah.
You see my point is that, you know, this is going to be a real reset in terms of 50 over cricket and white ball cricket. I think where you've seen, well, someone like Liam Livingstone, they've stuck with him for 2 years, and you're seeing the benefits of what he can do in this summer. So, I think it's now a great opportunity to see guys like Bethel, Brooke and that younger group to really get a long run at it and give it a real go, as opposed to chopping and changing. Just my opinion.
No, but that's right, isn't it, Georgia? Because you don't want someone coming in and doing well in three ODIs in India and then suddenly finding themselves not involved in the Champions Trophy because player X wasn't available just for those three ODIs in India.
Yeah, you know, completely right. I think for squad morale, I mean, we had it a little bit in the 2019 World Cup, didn't we, when Jofra Archer came in for David Willian. He'd been performing so fantastically well, and it really knocked him about. And I know from, you know, the effect that it has had on his career since then, it can really mess with the squad, with the wider squad. And, you know, I guess it is professional sport at the end of the day, so I kind of see it from both angles. That, you know, if it's Ben Stokes, you can't really be arguing. But for somebody, they would probably have their nose a little bit out of joint if they performed and then he comes in and takes their spot.
I
think it's a perfect time just to reset. And as I say, sometimes that's got to be, you know, right, we've drawn a line in the sand now. Brendan's taken over the white ball stuff. And this is the way we're going to go forward. You know what I mean? We can't just keep relying on the same old faces. We're going to get this team together and we're going to then look to move forward with that.
Okay, but on that...
Here we go.
I'm going to go on to the domestic side of things now because it all sort of ties in. And Sam, you talked about growing up on the 40-over, 50-over cricket. And there are loads of talented young players in this England side, but as we've all mentioned, that's through T20, cricket, really, and franchise cricket. How are we going to get the next generation of battle-hardened 50-over cricketers when the domestic 50-over competition is a little bit, isn't it, Sam, a reserve youth team tournament, give or take the odd county, if you're going to be blunt?
You're spot on, yeah. Kent did brilliantly a couple of years ago, winning the 50-over competition. It was brilliant for the club. You saw young players really thrive in that competition and get exposed to high-pressure moments. So there is a lot of positives in that competition. But, yeah, it is a second team in effect, as all the better players are playing in the 100 at the moment. So I don't see how it can change at the moment with the amount of cricket that is trying to be kind of fit in the home summer. So whether you play it in the first month of the year again, sorry, first month of the summer.
first month of the year.
Yeah, imagine January. Yeah, that'd be tricky. But,
would you still probably consider the Big Bash over a 50-over domestic tournament in January?
Maybe. I mean, Sydney or Canterbury on a cold one in January the 1st. But I think that's, at the moment, there's just too much cricket in the summer, plain and simple. So I can't see it changing, unfortunately.
It's sad, isn't it, Phil? I mean, look, we're
something's got to give. One of the competitions has got to go. One of the competitions have got to go, or there's got to be less games, or they've got to somehow try and condense it because there's just too much going on. We need the 50-over game, for my mind. So,
is 14 games of championship cricket too much, though?
Because we play
more four-day cricket than any other nation in the world. We don't produce 90-mile-per-hour bowlers consistently because people can't play week on week and run in and bowl 90 miles per hour. Just squads are way too thin to play 14 games a year. And, yeah, of course, the argument is we've always played that amount of cricket and whatever, but ultimately, counties survive on white ball cricket in terms of finances. So that's where the conversation is always going to be headed.
Yeah, it's got to be trimmed down somehow. Less games played from somewhere, or one of the competitions has got to give. Now, which one that is, they're all going to have their say, aren't they? And they're all going to, want to be at the forefront of it. But it just can't go on like this. It's as simple as that. And that's what comes back to my question earlier. Who's making these decisions? It just doesn't seem to be moving further down the line. We sit here and mull over it and scratch our heads, but nothing seems to happen.
No, nothing does. And nobody seems, do they, Georgia, to take the lead. And it is a sensitive conversation. It is a sensitive subject, and there are, loyalties and interests, and everybody has an interest in it, I suppose, and everybody gets the blame and everybody blames each other. And maybe to a certain extent, the Lancashire chief exec, Daniel Gidney, who I do know well, made the point, coaches get blamed, administrators get blamed. The blame is thrown about here, there and everywhere. It probably needs everybody to come together and accept culpability. I'm involved in Manchester in the 100. You have to, I suppose everybody has to accept some kind of culpability.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You need everybody to be sat down in a room and willing to have open conversations and willing to, compromise somewhere, because at the end of the day, it's the players' welfare as well. Being asked to turn up day in, day out and perform. I mean, I thought I played a lot of cricket, but compared to the lads, it's just relentless for them. And you see, them breaking down. And I was reading about Warwickshire's injury woes this summer as well, with their lack of, fast bowlers coming through. You just don't have the depth because the amount of cricket that is trying to be played is quite ridiculous. And I think for me, looking from an outsider kind of point of view, is the only solution I see is to play less four-day cricket. This is the only thing. I think you've got to prioritise the white ball game, you've got to prioritise 50-over cricket, but then you can't lose the T20 blast and the vitality blast, as it is, and the 100 from a financial point of view.
Oh, it's going to upset the members. All the members are going to get upset.
Yeah, but they have a stake, though, don't they, Phil?
Absolutely.
They have a stake.
Not at Hampshire anymore.
Well, and we're going to we're going to talk about that. But the money thing, that, and this will lead us into talking about Hampshire. But one of Daniel Guinea's other points when talking about the championship, for example, says more prize money would help. We need to find a way of paying four or five players a lot more money. And I suppose if you took a championship, you tie the 50 over in, because we're talking county cricket here. He said instead of £80,000 to £90,000 being the top domestic salary, we need to find a way of paying £200,000, and saying that part of that deal is you don't play franchise cricket. Is that pie in the sky, Sam?
Good luck, because I think it's a great conversation to have, because you know. Ultimately, sport, you know, best example is when the Premier League started with the football. It turned into a business from that day. So sport around the world is now business, whether we like it or not. And players, you know, whether it's players or organisations, are always trying to, you know, be financially more viable. So the white ball cricket keeps our game going. That's just, you know, it states facts. Around the world now. So if you try and prioritise four-day cricket, you have to highly incentivise people. And that's what people have done with the ECB central contracts, prioritising Red Bull cricket and getting guys so they don't go off to play franchise cricket. Whether you can do that for county cricket, it'd be great, but I'm not so sure.
Well, let's find out whether this Hampshire deal will lead to more money, well, certainly in one county's coffers, because Hampshire are going to become the first county to be owned by an overseas franchise. They've signed a deal with Delhi Capital's co-owners, the GMR Group. Kevin James covers Hampshire for Radio Solent, also played for the county. Evening, Kevin, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Mark. Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Tell us about the deal, then.
Well, it's very exciting. I wish I was a better businessman. I could sell you it in and out. But it's a historic day. And I think what's attracting the most attention is that it is the first county to be sold to a company that has an IPL franchise. You know, I think always the worry, you've been talking about the 100. I think there's always been a bit of a worry around the country about the 100. Full stop. And now here we are with an IPL franchise who's got sort of half a hand involved. I mean, first and foremost, it's a Hampshire deal. Rod Bransgrove, the majority shareholder and owner before this morning, has done a fantastic job down there for about the last 25 years. He's taken the club from a very small ground in the middle of Southampton and has helped them build a new ground on the outskirts. That Hampshire is a different entity to it was what it was when I played and when Phil played against them all those years ago. And he's done a fantastic job. And I think everybody down here trusts his judgment in selling to GMR. They were talking to a lot of people, and they've stayed with GMR for about a year. They actually agreed this deal about a year ago. And it's taken all this time to iron out all the details.
Let's hear from Hampshire's majority shareholder then. Here is Rob Bransgrove, who spoke to Kevin earlier today.
Out of all of the final bidders, we spoke to a lot of people. This took me nearly 2 years, this whole process. And we brought it down to about five or six companies that actually made a formal bid. We'd already liked GMR, to be honest, at the meetings we'd had, because what they have in common with us is their culture. They're run by a family. The father, who's my age, and his two sons and his son-in-law run the business. And it's got that familial feel, you know, that people care about each other and they take an interest in what everybody does. They're a very charitable group of people. And we just thought they were right for us. The people mix was fantastic. They bid what we were looking for. And so we accepted that offer and we've never regretted it.
It's not an immediate takeover, even though they've got a controlling stake now, but this is going to take 2 years, isn't it, to get the whole process done?
Yeah, well, one of the things they like about the business is the way it's run, and they didn't want to change anything there. They want me to stay, even at my advanced years, to stay for another at least 2 years, and no redundancies of any sort. So they just wanted to live with us for a couple of years to really get a feel for the business, which is their way, which I appreciate. And then probably I'll step down as chairman at that stage, and GMR will appoint their own chair. And they'll bring their own influence to bear even more on the business. But it won't be until they are very familiar with the way we do things, and I don't see them wanting to change anything.
Where do you see the benefits on the field, and what benefits and when? When will that start to show through?
Once again, you know, in the respect of domestic cricket, GMR love the way that we do it. You know, we have a setup which has a very strong development function. We have a production line which is producing first-team cricketers all the time. We like to field first 11s, which contain a mix of our development players and some elite professionals. On the surface, I don't think there will be any change at all in the way that we do things in domestic cricket. What it does do, of course, is opens up new avenues for our cricket with the potential for playing in other countries throughout the year. And in fact, we will be almost certainly joining a competition this November at an overseas location where we'll be sending a Hampshire team to participate in a competition that probably, without GMR's help, we wouldn't even have known about. So these are the kind of opportunities that will open up for us. Together, of course, with being a part of an international group, which increases the number of eyeballs on our product by hundredfold. So there aren't any real losers in all of this, you know. There's only winners.
Just finally, will it be the Hampshire Capitals playing in the county championship? Will it be the Southern Capitals playing in the 100 in the future?
Well, Hampshire will remain as Hampshire. As far as I'm aware, the Hawks will remain as the Hawks, and the Vipers could remain as the Vipers. There's discussions about that going on already. But in respect of the 100 franchise, we haven't actually opened this up for debate yet, but it is an interesting one because, you know, assuming that the ECB plans come to fruition, then we could change the name, and then we'll discuss that with our new owners to see what their objectives are and marry those with ours, and hopefully we'll come out with the right answer.
So that was Rob Brasgrove with Kevin James. Now, Kevin, when Rod's there, he's talking about everything from a Hampshire point of view. You can sort of understand it. What's in it for the GMR group?
Well, I mean, they're expanding, aren't they? I mean, they've already got stakes in the Pretoria Capitals in South Africa, the Delhi Capitals you mentioned, Seattle Orcas over in America. I think they've got interest at airports and what have you. I guess at the moment, there is a lot of interest, a lot of people around with money getting involved in sports, and that includes cricket. Now, why? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that I think we all thought there was a lot of money in county cricket. So where all of a sudden
but
is
they're
their
all,
interest?
They're all getting it. They're all getting in cricket in T20 formats, aren't they? They're getting into cricket in franchise formats.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So, you know, the 100 link is interesting. As I say, it's all about Rod because he's put a lot of money in it over the years. And he said, look, enough is enough. You know, so this deal is basically about them. But there is this sideline to this that they are a host county with 100 franchise. At the moment, as I understand it, every county, all 18 counties plus the MCC, whatever, have a very small interest in it at the moment. This stuff being banded around about the 51% that the ECB are going to hand the host counties isn't actually done. It actually isn't a done deal, as I understand it. And then the 49% the ECB keeps, and then they do what they want with that as well. At the moment, all counties have a little stake in the 100, which if that was divvied up at the moment, is a few million quid each. That's where this is going. And where a lot of counties that haven't got 100 franchises, and Sam will probably know a bit more about this with the count link than me than anybody, but that, you know, everybody's going to get some sort of payout. It's just that the host counties are more lucrative, you know, a better buy, I guess, because they have the 100. Hampshire not only have Hampshire, they've got the ground, they've got the hotel, they've got a golf club. So there is a lot about Hampshire that is attractive to a business.
Are the floodgates about to open on investment, Sam?
I think so. I think it's been coming for a while. Just to go back to your point, I think the GMR group, so I played for the Delhi Daredevils when it was back in, that was for the first franchise. I'm actually currently playing for the GMR group in Dubai, played last year. So knowing Kieran and the family very well, they are, as Rod alluded to, great human beings. It's a great family, and I think it's a perfect fit. Rod is exactly that kind of guy as well. So he deserves it for all the work that he's done down at Hampshire. And as you said, Kevin, it's an amazing journey that Hampshire have been on. And I think actually a lot of counties can take inspiration and interest from it, because I think certainly there's been a lot of chat around counties, how we need to trim them down. And it'll be very sad to do that. But counties need to survive, and that money or that input from external investors, I think, will need to happen up and down the country. Otherwise, you will get into a dangerous water like rugby has found itself. So I think it's really interesting, and I think it's a really positive move. I know people are sceptical around it, but I think it'll be fantastic for Hampshire in terms of that money. Mm. And I really do hope, from a Kent point of view, that the 51% rule for host counties doesn't come in. I think this will just be an easy way that Hampshire or certainly GMR have found a way of accruing 100% essentially of the host county otherwise. So I think everyone loses out in that respect. So, yeah, I really do hope that 51% doesn't happen. I think that will just make the gap between the host counties and non-host counties way too big, and probably you wouldn't be able to recover from that. And I think English cricket would change for the worse forever from that point of view.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. What is there to be scared of, J-Mo?
Did I give the impression there's I'm being scared or people are being scared?
There will be some in the game that are, though, Kevin.
We're going to lose control. We're going to it's just going to be franchise cricket. There's going to be no 4-day cricket. You know what I mean? What is the? Yeah. What? Why are people sort of like against this sort of like stuff? It just sounds like a good thing to me.
Well, it's like you. All summer, I hear so many people say that it's not good for the game. The 100. It shouldn't have been around. Keep county cricket the way it was. But the whole reason the 100 came in is because you couldn't keep county cricket the way it was, because audiences were dwindling. And by the time everybody sort of passed away, there'd be nobody watching any games. I mean, we're not far away from that at the moment. I think what's amazing is that you've got to remember that in 2020, 2021, there was no 100. There was nothing. And yet in 4 years, all of a sudden there's a product that could be distributed and is going to and counties will benefit it for many millions. I hear what Sam is saying. You know, that's quite an interesting point about host counties getting 51%. It's going to make the gap between those counties that have 100 franchises and the rest probably even bigger. But, you know, that 51% is still, as I say, not a done deal as I understand it. So there's probably plenty of negotiations to go around yet and other counties to say, look, hang on a minute. Perhaps this should be divvied up a little fairer.
Is the future from a player's perspective, Sam? And I'm not saying you're going to do this, but you've mentioned your link to the group and the teams that you play for within the group. Is the end game, do you think, that players end up signing for a group and then the group determine the schedule for that player amongst their teams?
It's already happened. Yeah, individuals have already signed for different groups around. Yeah. As Kevin said, you know, I think GMR have got 5 different teams around the world. They will add at least 2 more. Kolkata doing the same currently. The MLC is literally the tip of the iceberg. They're trying to crack into that baseball market, which is the fastest regressing sport in America. So huge subcontinent population over there. So yeah, we're seeing franchises around the world in multi different sports just going to new heights in terms of valuations. You saw how much the IPL franchises got sold for at the beginning of the year, and that's why you're seeing that expansion. So
often within multi-team groups, I'm not necessarily saying cricket, there then becomes a hierarchy of those teams. I suppose that will also worry some fans about, and I'm talking mainly from a football perspective here, where a team then will be within the hierarchy, within a multi-club. There are pros and cons to everything, Sam, aren't there, really? You know?
No, of course. So. And I think we're seeing, you know, county cricket, just to go back to this Hampshire thing, and I think where you could introduce it is the county system have a transfer system where smaller counties that produce quality players are then given a transfer fee like you see so many other football clubs do. So I think that's maybe the amount of money coming into the game, and that's how that keeps going around, I think.
Kevin, thank you very much for coming on this evening. Kevin James, who covers Hampshire for Radio Solent and also played for Hampshire. And we're going to stay on the South Coast. Bournemouth-Southampton is over. Chris Wise.
It is, and Bournemouth have won it by 3-1. They're 3 goals and the damage all done in the first half. Evan Nielsen with his first for the club. Dango Ouattara and Antoine Semenyo, all those 3 goals in a 22-minute period. Saints better in the second half. They had a bit of hope through Taylor Harwood-Bellis's header just after half-time, but they didn't have any big chances after that. It's 1 point from 6 games now for Southampton. And who have they got next? Arsenal away at the weekend. Bournemouth 3, Southampton 1.
Women's T20 World Cup gets underway on Thursday. England are among the favourites. Here's captain Heather Knight with Henry Moran.
We had a pretty big build-up in Abu Dhabi, so just really excited to play cricket now. I think as you get older, training camps become a bit slower, I guess, and you're just desperate to play. So, the challenges and things that have come with the World Cup are always really exciting. So, yeah, very much looking forward to getting going and creating some memories with this team.
What are those challenges ahead of a World Cup?
I think as captain, a lot more media duties, so a lot more sort of things on your plate, I guess. So making sure that you have a little bit of time to yourself and really have the extra time to get your own game in check is something that I've learned that's really important in those world events, because there's a lot going on. There's obviously 10 teams in one hotel as well due to the quick change of venue, so there's a lot of people milling around, and making sure you get time to yourself to switch off is quite an important one. There's been a few awkward lift conversations. Freya Kemp's the master of awkward lift conversations at the moment, but it's also exciting having those challenges of a World Cup as well. Obviously different team every time as well, that's a challenge for a captain, because you're preparing for a different team every time rather than sort of a series where you do the main bulk of it at the start and then little adjustments.
So you could be standing at the toaster at breakfast and chatting to the captain that you're about to face a couple of hours later.
Yeah, breakfast can get quite intense. I think everyone's sort of timing it so they don't run into everyone. It's just kind of the nature of what it is, having two grounds quite close together. I'm sure different teams will deal with it in different ways, but we've got a nice setup on our floor. Lots of board games and Lego and card games set out if we do want to bunker away just on our floor.
What about this change of venue? Because you would have been preparing up until pretty recently for a World Cup in Bangladesh. How has it shifted things that it's here in the UAE?
Yeah, I've been quite relaxed about it, to be honest. Completely out of our control, the change. We obviously knew it might happen in the lead-up. But I don't think a huge amount of changes. I think conditions will just be slightly less extreme in terms of the pitches. But, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Sharjah's obviously renowned for having a bit of low bounce and can be slightly trickier to bat on when the pitches are used, so we'll have to assess quite quickly. But yeah, obviously the heat has been a big talking point. It's been pretty hot and humid. The night games haven't been too bad, but a couple of day practices have been quite hard work, so being able to manage that is going to be key.
And what about the summer that you've just had, unbeaten? It was the perfect summer. Of course you want that as a captain, but equally you've got to be ready that if something does go wrong that you can pick the team up. I mean, how do you assess the summer just gone?
Yeah, really pleased with the summer. I think we've evolved a lot as a side. I think throughout the summer, I think what particularly impressed me was the way we played in that New Zealand series, the ruthlessness, the smartness, and it felt like really good evolution of what we're trying to do and how we kind of link in the way we want to play with being a bit smarter and a bit more streetwise, which is going to be really important in a World Cup.
Okay, big question. How do you beat Australia? They've won so many of these tournaments.
Well, I think how we played last summer was a bit of a blueprint. Obviously, they will have tried to evolve since then, as we have. So, yeah, I think being able to deal with those big moments, I think, is something they're very good at. They're obviously a hugely skillful team with a lot of depth, but as are we. We've got a lot of skill, and everything we've done the last few years is around building that squad depth, and we feel like we're in a really good place with that. And look, we feel like if we bring our best cricket to this competition, we've got a really good chance and can beat anyone on our day. So all we've got to do is try and bring our best cricket as much as we can.
Heather Knight talking to Henry Moran. Is it stop Australia? That has to be it for every team here, doesn't it, Georgia, really?
I know. I think we have the same conversation every World Cup, yeah. Don't we? It's how do we stop Australia? And to be honest, like, I think it's a mentality thing now. I think they go into World Cups as such strong favourites. We know that India, England, and South Africa can, on their day, pose a real challenge. But I think it's going to be really interesting, the mentality of those teams coming up against an Australia who have been there, done that.
Is it more a mentality on the other team's point of view, or the mentality on the Australians who just carry themselves in a way that they think they're invincible?
Well, they just don't know how to lose, do they? And I think it's the other teams coming up against them. When they get in themselves into those pressure moments in the big games, they need to find ways of pulling through and finding ways to win against an Australia side who doesn't know how to lose.
I think conditions are going to be huge, aren't they, Georgia, over there?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's quite interesting because England have not really changed tack with the squad that they would have taken to Bangladesh. They've included more spinners, whereas Australia have included more seamers. So they're perhaps reading it slightly differently. The games, most of them are going to be played at 6 p.m. at night, so you'd expect there to be dew, and a factor of, you know, playing under lights and winning the toss could be quite important. I think England will have a good chance, but they'll need to start well, and they didn't start very well in their warm-up game yesterday against Australia. So they've got a couple of days now before their first game. They play Bangladesh in the first game on the 5th, and you know, you'd expect them to come out of their group and make it through to the semi-finals.
Well, just very quickly, why didn't they adapt to the change? Why didn't they?
Well, it's interesting. I think Heather said that she doesn't expect conditions to be too dissimilar, maybe less extreme than Bangladesh. I think it will spin probably later on into the tournament. They're going to be used wickets. There's two venues, and all of the teams are going to be playing on those pitches. So you would expect that it to turn. And I think they will probably try and rotate their spinners as much as they can in the group games and try and find the balance of their best side.
We will leave it there. Thank you, all three of you. Phil, you can go and eat your tin of baked beans now.
Cheers, everyone.
All right. Sam, off for some jousting outside, is there? Or...
probably after, you know, some of the stick after what we've said on here. So, yeah.
Good stuff. Georgia, Sam, Phil, thank you very much. Every match, by the way, the Women's T20 World Cup live on Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. And there are highlights on the BBC Sport website and app as well. Scotland, Bangladesh gets it underway 11 a.m. on Thursday. England's opening game also against Bangladesh. And that's 3 o'clock on Saturday. Nick Bright on the way after Johnny Freeman with the news.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks, Mark. Good evening. Israel has told the US it has been conducting what it's called limited ground operations over the border in Lebanon. Tanks have been gathering on Israel's northern border and three areas that have been declared closed military zones. Lina Khatib is an associate fellow for Chatham House's Middle East and North Africa program. She thinks a ground offensive by Israel could spark a full-scale war.
This conflict is not going to end anytime soon because a ground incursion is going to be something that Hezbollah is well prepared for. Hezbollah has a lot of experience in asymmetrical warfare, so this is not going to be a swift job.
Well, there have been fresh calls today for a ceasefire from the U.S.